From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. In the aftermath of Ferguson, Milwaukee Congresswoman Gwen Moore hopes that the conversation turns to better police-community relations all over the country.
Nothing scares criminals away more than the disinfectant of police and the community working together.
Then Georgia Congressman, civil rights veteran, and now comic book author John Lewis talks about what he thinks college students should know about nonviolent protest. And we'll learn about one of the big challenges in maintaining a living history museum like Old World Wisconsin.
An environment where there's no air conditioning and there's no windows to keep the dust from blowing in and things like that can be harsh on these items, but we don't want to remove them because it just makes the buildings feel lived in.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Protests are continuing in the community of Ferguson, Missouri, over the shooting of an unarmed black teenager by a white police officer. But officials there said violence appears to be lessening nearly 2 weeks after 17-year-old Michael Brown was killed. Attention is now turning to the investigation and also to the implications Ferguson has for police-community relations in cities around the country. Representative Gwen Moore represents Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District, which includes parts of Milwaukee, in which tensions have often been high between law enforcement and the people they're sworn to protect and serve. Moore spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about her observations of the situation in Ferguson.
What goes through my mind is that just the total social disintegration of many of our urban communities, where we see such huge disparities in employment opportunities, educational opportunities. And the police are forced to try to pick up the pieces of this social injustice. My mother was born and raised in St. Louis. I'm very familiar with, West Florissant Street. Never heard of Ferguson, Missouri in my life before. But when you sort of pull back the curtain and look at some of those data that come out of there, you see that there's the largest income gap between blacks and whites in the country in St. Louis County. And you see a community that has evolved over the past decade or so. And the leadership in the community hasn't kept pace with the demographic shifts. And so Mike Brown's death really was a spark probably where a volcano of other kinds of emotions erupted.
Well, and you say in a situation like this, the police are left to pick up the pieces, and clearly what sparked the demonstrations and the clashes in the immediate aftermath was Mike Brown's death. I wonder if, though what you're saying here, not to put words into your mouth, is that what's gone on after that has as much to do with these other societal issues as it does Mike Brown's death?
Well, what I'm saying is that, true, Mitch, we have seen sort of a legacy of police shootings. I mean, Ferguson, New York, Milwaukee. You could just name the day, and it's a different city. So, the fact that it happened in Ferguson, Missouri is probably the most irrelevant part of it. Could have happened anywhere. We have seen this same pattern. But it's a pattern that evolves because the police have a fear of black male presence. Black males in the community don't trust the white police. That's a legacy issue. And I think that it evolves from a social contract that has not been kept or made. Because the truth is that the police need the community. So they talk about community-oriented policing. And the police and the people need the community. I think back with very, very heavy heart to the woman who lost her life when police didn't respond for 22 minutes. The community needs the police to protect and serve, which is their main mission. And the police need people to engage with them. This is one reason, Mitch, that I think that things like the residency requirement, where the governor has legislated that Milwaukee police officers don't need to live within the community, this is one of the disconnects that create a disconnect between the community and their police force.
In the days after Ferguson first started erupting, I read a graphic. It compared what percentage of the police in each city in America were African American versus the overall percentage of the population. Do you think that is an issue in a place like Milwaukee, for example?
It's result. It's a result. I mean, it's not necessarily causal. It's a result of the lack of engagement. This particular officer lived 25 miles from Ferguson. And again, people need to feel empowered within their own community. Their elected leadership needs to reflect their interests, not necessarily their color, but the same kind of politics. The police force needs to have that engagement. You need a police force where your kids and the police officer's kids maybe are in the same ballet class, go to school together, because then police become stakeholders in the community. You see that Captain Ron Johnson has come back from out of the highway patrol to lead the command there because he's someone, despite the meltdown we've seen, he has some credibility with that community.
Is this a case? I mean, when you look around your district, do you think are there things that are going right here, or do you look at this and say, you know, this is a case of there, but for the grace of God, go I. This could easily be happening in Milwaukee,
and it has happened in Milwaukee. We right now are seeing the big lawsuit regarding sexual assault in the police department. We're concerned about police response time. We're concerned about that relationship that needs to exist between the police and the community, that level of trust that gets us working together. I mean, nothing scares criminals away more than the disinfectant of police and the community working together. I'm thinking back fondly to just a couple of weeks ago when I pinned the badge of bravery from the Department of Justice on Officer Landa, where the Sikh community, the Sikh temple shooters, I mean, they are just in love with these officers. Captain Brian Murphy and Officer Landa, that community put up $100,000 toward Brian Murphy's recovery. And, you know, we have to remember that police officers do, you know, when there's the correct relationship, they're there to intervene because there are bad guys out there. But, you know, in the case of shootings with African-American black men, I mean, we do need some sort of truth and reconciliation around this legacy problem. Mike Brown today and who knows tomorrow. I've participated in these kinds of protests my entire adult life.
Do you think there is a role for national policymakers as this situation in Ferguson goes on and certainly in its aftermath?
Well, sure. You know, one of the things that we noticed that the local police department in Ferguson didn't have cameras in its 18 cruisers. They had received a Department of Justice federal money this year for two dash cameras, but they hadn't been installed yet. That was one of the things that I did back in the day before earmarks became such an evil thing, that I procured $100,000 for the Milwaukee Police Department to purchase these cameras. You know, it ensures the safety of the police and of citizenry to provide that transparency that the people in Ferguson are demanding at this point, accountability for behavior and explaining what the purpose of stops were, all the questions that are being asked now. That would have been something that could have given some answers. That versus a lot of the military-type equipment that police officers are purchasing. Just to have that transparency would help a lot.
There are some people who are talking about equipping all police officers with cameras that would be mounted on their uniforms at all time. Is that an appropriate level, or does that go too far in your eyes?
Well, I can tell you that it would protect police officers as well. Because right now, rightfully or wrongfully, the citizens of Ferguson are unwilling to wait until all of the evidence is in, until the county prosecutor, who they don't trust, county prosecutor's father was murdered by a black man. And, they're not willing to wait until the slow wheels of justice churn forward. They want the officer arrested today. And we don't have all the facts in. You know, a camera, it might exonerate him, or certainly it might show that he has some guilt around the shooting of Michael Brown. But without that, we can't make that discernment.
So what would your advice to the community of Ferguson be at this point? How do they start to unpack this?
Well, one of the things is that I would congratulate, if that's appropriate, the citizens of Ferguson for really – for putting these protests out there and really forcing a deeper look at it other than the regular okey-doke where the DA says, okay, we'll check this out and, drag it along. And then a year later, of course, the shooting was justified. And this is the low to no expectations that communities have had. Now we've got an unprecedented 3 autopsies, one by the prosecutor, one by the Department of Justice, the President Obama weighing in, and really very experienced and I'm sure expensive forensic pathologists who are coming in at the behest of the family. And I don't know the family's financial capacity, but I would guess that, Big Mike's parents on any other day would not have been able to get this kind of national attention from that kind of forensic pathology. So I would say that if they want to see justice, it's already sort of unfolding, and let the chips fall where they may, because they have this national spotlight is on it in a way that it's not in most of the shootings. Secondly, I'm not an attorney, Mitch. But I have watched the wall-to-wall coverage on this, and one of the attorneys made a real good point. At whatever point in time this officer is arrested, the clock toward a speedy trial begins. And so if they're not ready, if the prosecution is not ready with a case, he could just get away with it for lack of evidence and preparedness on their part. So what I would say is that their grief, their agony is certainly something that we can't deny them. But somewhere deep inside of them, to just reach down and find that steel spine to allow justice to move forward. And congratulate them for making this a national focus. And make sure that Michael Brown's death is not in vain. I think we do need some truth and reconciliation around racial profiling, around disparities in economic and educational opportunities, because I think that feeds not only rage and despair among African Americans, but it also feeds paranoia and perhaps trip trigger from a police department who has inherited all the social disintegration.
Congresswoman Gwen Moore, thank you so much for your perspective on this.
And thank you, Mitch. Look forward to being with you again.
Look forward to it as well.
Representative Gwen Moore represents Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District, which includes parts of Milwaukee. She spoke with Mitch Tyke. Coming up after a break, we'll hear from civil rights leader and another member of Congress, Representative John Lewis, who serves Georgia's 5th Congressional District. Lake Effect returns with that conversation right after this. We'll be right back. Lake Effect returns on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard from Representative Gwen Moore on the ongoing events in Ferguson, Missouri. In the wake of that fatal shooting, a so-called required reading list for Ferguson activists has been trending across social media. At or near the top of that list is a new comic book by Congressman John Lewis of Georgia and Andrew Aiden. March, Book One, tells the story of John Lewis's childhood in the segregated South, his formative meeting with Martin Luther King Jr., and the organization of the Nashville Student Movement and its fight to integrate lunch counters. While it may be recommended reading in Ferguson, it was required reading for incoming freshmen at Marquette University. In the coming days, students and faculty will discuss the lessons in that book. Lewis and Aiden were at Marquette yesterday and sat down with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. Congressman Lewis put the events in Ferguson in the context of his own experience in the civil rights movement.
When I observe and read about what is happening in Missouri, in this town, Ferguson, I said to myself, oh, I thought those days were behind us. I thought we had come much farther along, but we're not there yet. On one hand, I wish I could be there to try to teach some of the young people the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. That when you protest, try to do it in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion. And that you respect everybody. Respect the police officers. Respect members of the National Guard. Respect your fellow protesters. Do what you can to build that sense of community, that sense of one family, because in the final analysis, we all live in the same house, part of the same family.
And maybe it's an obvious question, but why is it so important in your eyes that this take place in a respectful, non-violent way? I mean, there are obviously some people who are truly angry.
But when people engage in violence, they're trying to speak out in the only way that they know how. Dr. King said in the past that violence is the message of the unheard. People feel like they haven't been listened to. They haven't been considered. So people find the best way they can to display their feeling, their frustration, their sense of discontent. But we have to say to people, there's a better way, a more effective way. And that's what we did during the 60s. When we protested, we did it in an organized fashion. And we spoke with one strong voice. We were not out to loot, to burn, to kill, to tear things down, but to build, to be reconciled, to build a sense of community.
The book that you have written and that, Andrew, you have co-written in this case, many are citing as required reading. In fact, here at Marquette University, it has been required reading, but others are saying this is something that people in Ferguson would be well served to read. What is the message that I guess either of you or both of you hope that people who are involved on the ground in a place like Ferguson today will get out of reading this book, this history?
I think there is a real sense of discipline and orderly protest that they had in Nashville that made it uniquely successful. Within that, what created that was a sensitivity for the tactics and the use of protest as a means to make their voice heard. What we try and show in March is that those tactics were creative, they were disciplined, and they were used to great effect. And that hopefully protesters today will understand that those rules that they live by, that they conducted these protests under, are universal and conducive to the protest today.
What is the risk that you think people run if they don't abide by those rules and take that creativity to heart?
It's marginalization. If you can't follow the rules that have been so successful in the past, following in this tradition of Gandhi and Martin Luther King and others, then you will be marginalized. You will be unsuccessful.
And it's become much more difficult, much harder to win support. When you engage in a nonviolent campaign, you are able to get hundreds and thousands of people to follow and believe in your cause. And everybody can participate in a nonviolent campaign. It doesn't matter whether you're young, middle-aged, or old. You just present your body. You don't need guns and bricks. You don't need your weapon. It's peace. It's love. It is nonviolence.
Well, and let me ask a question that maybe shows the cynicism of our times. Do you think there are those out there that would fan the flames of violent protest in an effort to try to marginalize this cause and others like it?
There may not be a deliberate, systematic effort on the part of people, but I think from time to time that individuals come along to try to take advantage of a very bad situation and use it for other means, for other purpose.
Is there a difference in the message or the lesson that you hope people will get from this book when you come to a place like Marquette? And I'm not saying that there aren't people, there aren't students at this university who take part in protests, nonviolent protests, but you're speaking to a student body that is geographically removed and probably in a lot of other ways removed from the kinds of issues that are just below the surface in a place like Ferguson. What do you hope that students at a place like Marquette get from this history?
It is my hope that students here at this great university would be inspired by the history, by the passion of another generation of students and young people that were deeply inspired by the action of individuals like Gandhi, of Martin Luther King Jr., and Rosa Parks, Thoreau, and others. We didn't have money. We didn't know anything about the internet. Hadn't heard of social media. But we used what we had. We used our bodies. We believe in the moral force, in the goodness of humankind, and we appeal to that. We were arrested. We were jailed. We were beaten. But we never lost hope. We never gave up. We kept the faith. We kept our eyes on the prize. And we won. We had a great victory. And we're saying to people today through March that you, too, can follow in that tradition.
Andrew Iden, can you put this book in a historical context and compare it to others that came before?
You know, during the late 50s and early 60s, there was a number of comic books that were used to help educate and inspire the earliest days of the civil rights movement, in particular one called Martin Luther King and the Montgomery Story. But there were others. There were some from the NAACP. There were some from SNCC. And they were used in particular to show the finer points, to show the details in an illustrative way that reached the broadest possible audience. And that's what we're trying to do now with March. People don't think that Dr. King ever read comics, much less helped edit one. But in fact, he did in the fall of 1957. And, you know, I really believe that we've come to a point where it's time for the students, for the young people, to form a new organization similar to SNCC that operates on a national level and coordinates nonviolent activities, that leverages the power of social media to not simply create passive acts such as clicking or retweeting or liking, but to create action, to inspire young people to use their bodies, to put themselves out there, and to create direct action campaigns when we see injustices, whether it be in Ferguson or elsewhere.
Do you think that call is stronger to students coming in this graphic form?
Absolutely. As we see with Comic-Con culture growing all across America, the number of graphic novels being checked out from our libraries is the fastest growing section of any platform in the library. This is what young people read. This is what I read. I mean, I'm a pretty big comics fan, and I have been almost my entire life. So I think by putting it in this way, we make it plain, as Congressman and others have said during the Civil Rights Movement, you got to make it plain. You got to make it simple and make it so that they can understand, and that's what we're trying to do.
Congressman, did it take any convincing to want to tell this story in a comic book form?
Well, it did take some convincing, but it was not that hard. It was not that difficult. And Andrew came to me and said, Congressman, you should write a comic book. He was on the way to, after the campaign was over, to Comic-Con, a convention, and people started making fun of him. And I said, you shouldn't laugh. You should make. That was another comic book, the one he just spoke of, edited by Martin Luther King Jr. That inspired me and others. And I'm glad I said yes. I'm glad that we did it. And people reading it all over America and even abroad.
You've now served in Congress since 1987. How do you feel your calling in the political world has changed in the 27 years you have been an elected official?
Well, as an elected official, and in the Congress in particular, I feel, to some degree, freer to say what I want to say, do what I want to do, and speak up and speak out. Because the folks that elected me, they've been very good to me, and I tried to be good to them. Now, some may disagree with me, but they would say John Lewis is an independent person, and he would do what is right, he would do what is fair, and I'm going to continue to support him, and I'm going to continue to vote for him. But I tell him, you know, I'm going to speak up. I'm going to get in trouble. But it's good trouble. It is necessary trouble. So I hope that this book, March, will inspire another generation of young people and those of us not so young to get in trouble. Be bold. Be courageous. Just go for it. I happen to think in this day and age, as Americans, we're too quiet. We need to make some noise. We need to move our feet.
Well, Congressman John Lewis and Andrew Iden, thank you both so much, and best of luck.
But thank you very much. Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be with you, Mitch.
Representative John Lewis serves Georgia's 5th Congressional District. He's the co-author, along with staffer Andrew Iden, of the comic book March, Book 1. The book is required reading for Marquette University's incoming class. Lewis and Iden were at Marquette yesterday, where Lewis was awarded an honorary degree, and they spoke with Mitch Tyke. Coming up next, how Old World Wisconsin balances preserving historic artifacts with presenting reproductions when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. History is becoming increasingly accessible to us online. Newspapers and books are digitized, historic census records are easy to navigate and search through, and images and video of historic artifacts can be viewed. But despite all of these technological advances, we can't experience living in the past while sitting in front of our computers. Old World Wisconsin, which is sponsored by the Wisconsin Historical Society, is known for its living museum. Crops are grown there, livestock is raised there, and historic primitive buildings from around the state have found a home there. Jennifer Van Haften is the museum's Associate Director of Programs and Historical Resources. She told Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson how the museum balances its hands-on mission while also trying to preserve the artifacts.
We are definitely dedicated to preserving history, especially items that are related to Wisconsin, in the best possible museum ethic, code of ethics and rules and that kind of thing. But what we do try to do a lot of around Old World is to make reproductions or find items that maybe don't necessarily have a Wisconsin provenance, a Wisconsin background, but still represent something from Wisconsin. And we add those to something we call a teaching collection. So all of those items are designated, you know, for use with the public, with our staff that are here to chat with people. They're there to demonstrate, to get people to try it out. So it's so much better than, you know, maybe you see something at your local historical society or you've seen an interesting spinning wheel over at the Milwaukee Public Museum, but that's behind a window or a glass or something, and you're like, how does that work? And we are lucky enough that we can demonstrate how it works and then say to you, hey, you want to try this out yourself and have you try it out, you know, see what it feels like, see what it sounds like. You know, we have wood-burning stoves that are cast iron for cooking. You smell the stuff coming out of the oven. You stir things in ceramic bowls with wooden spoons. Not much different than what we do today, but there's still the technologies of, you know, there's no timer on that oven, so you need to check it maybe a little bit more often. Your measuring cups are not as standard as they are nowadays, and so you find out that it's why grandma was a pinch of this and a little bit of that is because she was really just kind of guesstimating herself too and doing more proportions than rather an exact science of measuring cups and spoons. And being able to sit down in places, we've got one location where we've remade the bed. It's a reproduction bed, and you can lay on it and see what corn husks inside a tick feels like. So we try really hard to make things as accessible as possible. On the other hand, people do get the opportunity to see real artifacts out on our site, too. An environment where there's no air conditioning and there's no windows to keep the dust from blowing in and things like that can be harsh on these items, but we don't want to remove them from the environment either because it just makes the buildings feel lived in. They're fuller, they're richer. This is what a family's life must have been like back in the past, depending on where you happen to step into a building on our site.
What happens with the preservation of the artifacts, especially if they are outside or in these buildings that don't have the air conditioning or most likely don't have a now standard furnace? How do you preserve these artifacts?
We do something that's called preventative conservation. So a lot of it has to do with basic housekeeping like we do at home. And I bet you didn't know that you were preserving things in your home. When you sweep out the dust, when you dust off surfaces, that's removing gritty things that can wear down surfaces. When you just try not to use them very much, not get your hands all over them, that helps protect things. We do have we have a staff person of one with, you know, a few good core volunteers, and she goes around every spring and every fall. And a number of items in the fall are removed to a building that does have heating and cooling systems that are appropriate for preservation. So at least 6 months out of the year, our very delicate stuff are in interiors that, you know, protect them. But like I said, we hate to not put them back out because then, you know, you lose the fullness of what life would have been like in the past. But a lot of preventive conservation, there's a lot of vacuuming of textiles in the spring and the fall. The curator is out vacuuming spaces where the dustpans and dust brooms haven't gotten everything. So it's just real constant maintenance and just making sure you keep the dust off as much as possible.
If you had a textile, for instance, that had a rip in it, would you have the curator or the preservation specialist fix it, or would you allow the hole to be there? Because then you'd be maintaining the history instead of manipulating today's technology onto the original textile. How would you manage that?
It always depends on circumstances. So depending on the provenance, if it has a really strong Wisconsin connection, a really strong connection to any of our families that our buildings represent on the site, some of those things probably won't necessarily end up in our buildings if they do start to get into a deteriorated condition. Sometimes we do send things out to professional conservators. In fact, our altar railing over at our St. Peter's Church, we had a conservator come in and refurbish it, repaint it with appropriate tools. Reversible methods are things that we often talk about in the museum field, all those kinds of things. And it's still out there where people can see it. We did get the funds to be able to hire a conservator to do that. So depending on the item and how special it is and what its connection might be, we'll get somebody in to fix it. Otherwise, it might be removed from our environment. We might make a reproduction of it to protect it, and that's often what happens. A number of tables and chairs out here have been removed, but they have been reproduced, and those are replaced in the buildings to take care of them.
Does a factor or a different kind of preservation happen when you have these plexiglass walls that are barring the people from the original rooms?
We try to avoid those as much as possible, but a number of those particular rooms either have original carpeting, original furniture that we can't necessarily, we don't have enough staff people to say, you know, this is not appropriate to sit on because we actually are trying to preserve it for future generations, but we do have a chair over here for you to try. So we don't necessarily have enough staff to put in every room to explain everything that everybody sees. So yeah, we do try to maintain the integrity of some of these items. But if some of the carpeting is original, and if we had people walking over it every day with the dust and things like that, it would get worn out. So that would be why we maintain some of our rooms with kind of plexis in between the visitor and the items in the rooms.
And also the oils on your hands as well can be kind of detrimental in a way to these original artifacts.
Oh yeah, that's definitely part of it too. But we try to maintain as much of a, this is what life was like. So for the 1860s, we want people to feel like, oh, I'm stepping into an 1860s home. So we don't want to hand them booties. We don't want to hand them cotton gloves. We want them to feel like that they're coming into a house and maybe they are get invited to the back kitchen to help the hired girl make the cookies for the family's dessert or something like that. And so a number of the items in the kitchens or in our dining rooms, a number of rooms are reproduction items so that people can handle, can carry around. And it's interesting how you can find a lot of these things online and websites, and there's kind of a small market for it, but a number of living history sites around the country kind of keep that market going, and that's great for us because then that means we can add more things that people can try out and see and just imagine with that item in their hand what life must have been like.
And you can also change out the exhibit instead of, well, I've already been to Old World Wisconsin. I know what's already there. But you are able to change out some of those artifacts and to kind of change also the different eras that you're representing, correct?
Well, we do have certain eras that each building is designed to represent. But everything that's going on in each building changes from day to day. And so, like in our 1860 Sanford home, during the month of August, we're doing our Civil War encounters. And so we can bring out some reproduction items that represent what people would have been doing on the home front for relief efforts for the soldiers. And so today, right now, we have a number of different things. We've got our shooting mittens, and actually they're reproductions, and people can actually try them out, making them themselves. And so we have a number of felt pieces out here, and then thread and needles, and people can examine them and put their hands in them if they want to. And see what a shooting mitten was like. And then there are also our relief items. And so they would have been filling bags. And we often have bags for people to fill things in. This particular month, we have clothing that guests can try on and see what a hoop skirt was like or what a long skirt was like and just kind of get a sense of what it was like to live in a skirt. So we're really excited to offer that particular thing every day. So that's neat to have. And like I said, again, it's to give people more of a sense of, if I lived back then, what would this feel like?
things that you really cannot explore or experience while surfing online.
And that's what I always tell my kids, too. My son is a very online sort of entity. And when I try to explain to him, you know, but it's not the same as going there. Or I had an argument with my daughter about she didn't want to grow up and have to dissect animals in high school science classes. And we were discussing it. And she's like, well, why couldn't we just do that online? I'm like, but it's not the same, honey. It really
you need
isn't.
The formaldehyde smell.
You need to get in there and see the squishiness and understand what it's really like. But yeah, I mean, I think that goes for history as well, too, is that the United States is so lucky to have so many living history museums. And if you've got one in your backyard, you really should try it on for size. And Old World Wisconsin is great because it can take you from the 1840s all the way up to the 19-teens. So you can cover a good portion of the 19th century, you know, checking out our entire site.
Definitely. Old World Wisconsin right now is featuring the Civil War, and the interpreters play such an essential role to this because they have to study and interpret what it was like to be a person, whether it's a soldier or a family member back home, during the Civil War, what it was like. So what do they need to do in order to embrace the role of these people from 200 years ago? How much studying do they need to do?
Quite a bit, and we don't expect everybody to know everything. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, most of the people, when they first come on, they are assigned a particular building or a particular farmstead. And so they do have a manual that gives them a lot of information and background about the household, where it came from in Wisconsin, what was going on at the time, what the ethnic background of the family was. Old World has actually three 1860s time period houses. One is a Norwegian ethnicity, one is a German ethnicity, and then the one that we're checking out today is Yankee, so anybody who came from the New England areas. And all those people had different foods that they ate and different beliefs about, you know, whether they should go to war or not. And a lot of that information is already in those manuals to begin with. And then additionally, any of our events that we do, we set out some additional information. So for the Civil War encounters, we added some more information about sending relief boxes to soldiers and filling bags and rolling bandages and what they would do about packing those boxes and the cookies they would bake, or they would bake entire cakes and ship those. I mean, and I think about soldiers today and people baking them cakes and sending treats and goodies. It was the exact same thing in the 1860s. And I think we don't always make the connection that we really haven't changed that much from, you know, 1860 to the present day. And, you know, we always think about how foods need better preservation or something. But really, you know, if you've got a cake in a box for a week, it's going to be essentially okay. I think we've all eaten a little bit stale stuff just because it was a sweet treat, nice to have. The families probably feel the same way our families do today, who have soldiers over in Afghanistan, you know, or left behind in Iraq to, you know, teach the Iraqi soldiers, and they want to send them things. And that's exactly how these families in the 1860s felt about their soldiers going off to war. And interestingly, the different immigrant groups, a lot of them really did support the Union cause and felt it was their duty to sign up. So you will see Norwegian units, you will see German units, and many of them out of Wisconsin, you'll see Irish, entirely Irish units, and there's lots of histories behind them. We can't cover all of that in one sitting, but what we hope to do is to pique everybody's interest enough that they'll go looking for the information additionally. And many great stories are told, like, by the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. So, you know, there's another place where you can go for more information. And so we're just trying to get the interest started and hoping that people will pursue it a little bit more than when they get home, when they travel elsewhere on the road. You know, just ask those questions. Pick up a book. Watch a television program. Just add to their knowledge.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for telling us about Old World Wisconsin and what we can see at Civil War events here at Old World Wisconsin.
Okay, well, thank you for having me. And we are doing many Civil War-related things throughout the entire month of August through Labor Day, September 1st.
Excellent. Thank you.
Jennifer Van Haften is the Associate Director of Program and Historical Resources at Old World Wisconsin. She oversees the events that take place at the museum. She spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson. Tomorrow, we'll speak with Ryan Schwartz about this weekend's Civil War event, Gone for a Soldier. And there's more information about the museum and all of its events at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then a Lake Effect essayist and first-generation immigrant recalls the distance she felt between her and the people around her as she was growing up in Milwaukee. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. To be a child of immigrant parents is to grow up with an encyclopedia's worth of what people like to call, quote, colorful stories, unquote. So says Lake Effect essayist Alexandra Rosas.
I am a first-generation American, and I could fill volumes with colorful stories. When you're a new American, you grow up in a home where one foot is in the new country and the other foot is stubbornly planted in the old. My five siblings and I didn't really know how unusual and different life was from the one we knew at home. We thought everyone lived a double life, that of two cultures. When we'd come home from school, with that first twist of the doorknob walking back into our house, we were instantly back in the old country. When that door closed behind us, the United States of America ceased to exist. In my case, welcome to Colombia. Like most immigrant families, ours was an extended one under one roof. We lived with my non-English-speaking Colombian grandmother. She never really understood that we were in a new country to stay. As far as she was concerned, she had just come along for the plane ride and thought this visit was the longest vacation she'd ever been on. My grandmother came from a small village in Colombia, where she was one of the revered few who knew the ways of natural plant remedies. She was versed in plant pharmacology for all the plant types that Colombia is known for. If we had an upset stomach, my grandmother would treat it with yerba buena, literal translation, good weed. She would send me to school with a thermos full of mate, or good weed drink. My schoolmates, I call them schoolmates because I had no friends, weird wasn't cool in 1966, would ask me what I was drinking that smelled so sweet. In consideration for the fact that they didn't know Spanish, I would give them the literal translation, good weed drink. They, kindly in return for my accommodation of their lack of Spanish, would run home and tell their parents about the Colombian children in their school who drank good weed drink for lunch. In Colombia, my grandmother was entrusted with preparing the town's celebratory drink, known as chicha. Preparing chicha is an art, and there is a specific process. For one, you must allow the drink to ferment for a lunar cycle, and depending on the occasion, adjust the main ingredients accordingly. The main ingredients? Cannabis or coca leaves. Say you were planning a journey of 2 days or more across the Andean Mountains, and you don't want to have to slow down your travels by having to stop to sleep or eat or other pesky things that your body needs. Well, you would just add more coca leaf in your chicha. I tell you all this to explain a day in 1966 when my five siblings and I became the first known Latino gang in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. As children, we always had headaches. Tension, perhaps? My grandmother, the herbalist, would home remedy this by taking an orange, peeling it, placing the orange peelings inside one of her brightly colored bandanas, then securing the bandana around our heads, just above our eyelids. Something in the orange peels was supposed to act on the headache by shrinking the swollen blood vessels in our throbbing heads. But what happened instead was that we would all go outside to play looking like mini gang members. Innocently, we would knock on neighbors' doors, our heads tilted up in an attempt to see something from out under our red bandanas. We would stand on the neighbors' front porches, orange peeling slipping down, the smell of citrus attracting gnats and wasps to our heads, and eagerly ask if the children could come play with us. No one was ever available. Each time we'd knock on a door, we'd be told that the children were busy or getting ready to go somewhere else. Maybe another time, the mothers would tell us. I remember a mother's reply when an American child asked her who we were and why we had scarves with oranges tied around our heads. She said, "We don't want to know." We were the neighborhood oddity. I didn't know it then, but I do now. I have many colorful stories from my childhood. I tell them to our three children, and we laugh. I decided when they were born that I can either paint a picture for them of me feeling lost, alone, and rejected, or I can laugh with them and be thankful that the childhood I had was one that has given me many nights of storytelling, and I'm not even close to running out. In life, when I'm given a choice between laughter or tears, I always choose laughter. But I no longer choose orange-filled bandanas.
Lake Effect essayist Alexandra Rosas is a contributing author of the Her Stories Project, as well as other anthologies. She's also a Milwaukee Grand Slam storytelling champion for The Moth, and she lives with her family in Cedarburg. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North, thanking you again, as always, for tuning in. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect, from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.